also owns a fleet of unmanned aerial vehicles and explosive drones. On top of that, Hezbollah is expected to use advanced anti-tank and anti-ship missile launch systems. In words of a Hezbollah field commander who gave an exclusive interview to Lebanese Al-Akhbar daily last week, the task for the military formations of the Islamic Resistance is to break Israel in any future battle, as this is considered one of the first steps towards its elimination. In short, as a sitting duck, Israel awaits Hezbollah's winter fire. Welcome to the Middle East stream, I'm Marwa Osman. It is set. In the absence of an agreement in the coming weeks that would regulate the maritime borders between Lebanon and the Zionist Israeli entity, Hezbollah will move towards what it already warned the Israeli entity against, a war to preserve Lebanon's rights in its natural resources. Israel is striving not to reach war because, as simply put by a prominent Hezbollah field commander who gave an exclusive interview to the Lebanese Daily Al-Akhbar newspaper, if Israel leads us to war, we will fight it vigorously. The field commander warned that any upcoming war will be devastating for the Zionist entity in every sense of the word, affirming that the destruction of the entity will be greater than it ever imagined. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Dr. Mikhail Awad, author, political commentator, and media director of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance. Thank you very much for being with us, Dr. Awad. Now, at the center of the resistance decision-making process in Lebanon, the trend was clear-cut. As one field commander, a jihadi leader in the resistance, Hezbollah, told Al-Akhbar, he said Hezbollah has entered a new phase and the mission of the resistance has evolved and its features have changed. Can you translate that on the battlefield as the tension rises between Lebanon and Israel as we approach September and the maritime border dispute is yet to be resolved between both sides?
This is the new phase that the resistance and all of the axes have entered. As Sayyid Nasrallah announced when he raised his finger and said, just as the land is ours, so is the water and all what is beneath it. Just as the skies are also ours, after the resistance declared its position of air defense weapons. What the field commander and Hezbollah stated for Al-Akhbar is just a translation of the resistance and its axes completing its preparations and all elements of transition from a defense strategy to an attack strategy. We see this in different battlefields. It is reflected practically in Lebanon. As the Islamic resistance have begun setting dates for confrontations, it has also started setting its options and directions. The upper hand in this matter is clearly for Hezbollah, when it declares that during September the maritime registration should take place as per the demands of the Lebanese government, or else there will be no gas and oil to be extracted, not only at the border with occupied Palestine, but rather throughout the entire eastern part of the Mediterranean. This means that the resistance will be the initiator of this upcoming confrontation and that the resistance's demands will be met without any deficiency. The enemy and its allies have no time for procrastination and maneuvering. If things head towards a military confrontation, then the resistance will be the one to decide 0 hour, the battlefield location and the mechanism to end this confrontation. There is no doubt that there will be a confrontation between Israel and the Islamic resistance Hezbollah in Lebanon. If not because of maritime disputes, then it will be ignited for the many other disputes. In my personal opinion, I believe this war will take place either within weeks or within the upcoming 3 months, tops. At that point, when it happens, it will be dubbed the War of Liberating Palestine from the river to the sea.
Well, that is one dream that every true Arab is looking forward to, Dr. Awad. But another shocking statement that this anonymous field commander of Hezbollah said was that the enemy should know that the war with Hezbollah this time means the destruction of the infrastructure of the Israeli entity, which will turn the settlers' lives into real hell, unquote. What difference does it make if that actually happens when Lebanon also gets hit by the Israeli entity and its already weakened infrastructure is all destroyed? I mean, what good can that bring with such statements, if you will.
The Zionist entity has always attempted to terrorize the Lebanese public by claiming that it possesses a massive destructive power, whether via war jets or via precision missiles which are capable of causing grave damage. Hence, the threats made by Hezbollah field commander concerning the destruction of the Israeli entity's infrastructure is upping the ante in the face of the constant Zionist threats. This is a strategy aiming at challenging the enemy by openly saying that our destruction equals your destruction too. For instance, during this past weekend, a voice recording was leaked, most probably from within the circles of the resistance, calling the resistance fighters and the civilians alike who reside at bordering villages to occupied Palestine to be careful when they enter the liberated Palestinian villages in the Upper Galilee to protect property, cars and the security in those areas. This all means that he who decides upon 0 hour, which most probably be Hezbollah, will also control the course of the battle. When the battle begins and Hezbollah resistance fighters enter the Upper Galilee, Israel will not be able to maneuver, neither in geography nor in its ability to launch missile attacks, nor make use of its Iron Dome, nor its war jets that might not even find runways to land on when they return after the air raids. So this speech about destruction emphasized the increasing capabilities of the resistance, not only in precision missiles and armed drones, but also that its firepower is similar to that of the Israeli enemy, fully capable of causing major damage and destruction inside enemy lines. Mind you, this speech is very effective at the psychological level, knowing that the Zionist settlers are not the kind that remain steadfast during confrontations. On the contrary, they would rather flee than stay behind and fight for their entity. If this war will take place, it will do so within the heart of the Palestinian land.
Well, but there's one other thing that actually is a challenge for Hezbollah, and that is the internal political foes of the Islamic resistance in Lebanon. In the event of a war between the Lebanese resistance and the Israeli entity, do you think that Hezbollah's back, meaning the internal Lebanese arena, will be actually safe for the resistance, or we will be seeing for the first time several fronts being utilized against the Lebanese resistance with the internal Lebanese land with it? With 1 minute, please.
In the event of a war, I believe that Hezbollah's back will be fully protected from within the Lebanese territory against all rumors. This time, the back of the resistance will be more protected than the last war in 2006. Because in 2006, the resistance faced a huge challenge internally, initiated by the cabinet and its prime minister at that time. We had back then ministers who not only covered for the massacres committed by the entity, but also provided the enemy with intel about resistance locations. This presented a grave danger to the resistance. However, today, whatever happens, even if a war breaks out, we know that the entire Lebanese regime stands behind the Lebanese resistance. Just 2 weeks ago, when the American envoy negotiating the maritime dispute, Amos Hochstein, he met with all three presidencies and they all stood behind the resistance. Which means that the actual Lebanese government, unlike what we were used to from former governments, actually stands in a different place, in support of the resistance. That was applicable due to Hezbollah's wisdom that kept reminding everyone that the resistance and its weapons stand in service of all of the Lebanese people, to retain sovereignty and to help Lebanon out of its current crisis. In short, if one morning we woke up and suddenly saw the flags of Hezbollah and Palestine raised upon the illegal Zionist settlements, it will be a magnificent scene, not only in Lebanon, but all across the Arab and Islamic world.
Well, across the whole world, that is a dream and that we wish will come true and we believe will come true. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Mikhail Awad, author, political commentator, and media director of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance, for joining us. Thank you for your contribution. Please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about the escalating targeting of the U.S. occupation bases in Syria. Well, since 2016, the U.S. occupation Al-Tanf base has been located at the intersection of the Syrian-Iraqi-Jordanian border, supposedly housing Maghawir al-Thawra faction, as it was the base that was established to fight Daesh. Coincidentally or not, the presence of Daesh is still concentrated in the nearby valleys of that specific base, a presence that is activated from time to time, perhaps to bring an international justification to extend the life of the American occupation of Syrian territory. However, these attacks have intensified and expanded hours after the American assault on Deir ez-Zor last week, putting these attacks at a pace of systematic escalation separate from any possible political development in Vienna. Targeting U.S. occupation in Syria intensifies in this following report. Washington is deliberately heating up the front against the auxiliary forces of the Syrian army after the bases of the former in Al-Tanf and Al-Umar were repeatedly bombed. However, the response of the Syrian Arab Army forces was also not late, as they targeted American occupation bases again amid expectations that these attacks would only escalate in the future. An escalation that appears aimed at doubling the pressure on the U.S. forces of occupation to push them to leave Syria in light of the Astana trio, Russia, Iran, and Turkey, agreeing on this end goal. Not a few hours had passed after U.S. occupation warjets attacked positions of auxiliary forces of the Syrian Arab Army in the Ayyash area in Deir ez-Zor, until these fighting groups responded by targeting the two bases of the international coalition in the Conico and Al-Umar oil fields in the eastern countryside of Deir ez-Zor, which hosts American, British, and French occupation soldiers. As a result, there were casualties among the coalition forces. The U.S. military announced that an American soldier was slightly wounded, while two others were being examined for minor injuries following missile attacks in Syria at their occupation bases. On the other hand, the American forces targeted again Syrian Arab Army points in the Hawija Saqr area near Deir ez-Zor and near the city of Al-Mayadin and Jabal al-Thurda, all knowingly Syrian Arab Army positions and not, as the U.S. claims to be, Iranian-backed forces. This development prompted the coalition to mobilize its forces and to request the Kurdish separatists' leadership to deploy fighters along the Euphrates River, separating its areas of U.S. control and those under the Syrian Arab Army's control in participation of attacks from the latter against the former. For its part, the U.S. Central Command acknowledged in a statement that its bases had been bombed, pointing out that several missiles fell within the vicinity of the mission support base in Conico. A short time later, rockets landed near the mission support site in the Green Village, also known as Al-Umar Field. Perhaps what reinforces Washington's fears in this context is that the fighting groups that used to target the vicinity of American occupation bases with mortars and rockets without causing significant material damage to the bases themselves, this time deliberately dropped all the missiles on the two bases' headquarters, with the aim of producing the greatest possible damage in them, and emphasizing that the following targets will directly hit those sites, in order to double the military pressure on the Americans. Perhaps the U.S. announcement of the state of alert reflects the influx of intelligence information about the possibility of a military escalation against the coalition occupation bases in both Syria and Iraq, in light of the Syrian, Russian, Turkish, Iranian consensus on the need for the Americans to leave Syria. Now to discuss this issue with us from Damascus is Mr. Tahsin Halabi, political commentator and researcher. Thank you very much for being with us, Mr. Halabi. And I know that you are suffering from electricity outages and several other technical issues. So I thank you for being with us despite these technical difficulties in Syria because of the sanctions. Now, let's begin at the center of the resistance in Syria against the U.S. occupation and with the escalation of the targeting of the American Al-Tanf base. We see that these attacks not only include Al-Tanf, but also Al-Umar and Conico field bases as well, and they came in the wake of the American aggression on Deir ez-Zor, targeting Syrian Arab Army forces, which Biden directly ordered himself. But in light of this boiling nuclear file in Vienna, how do you assess this escalation against U.S. occupation bases inside of Syria?
I believe that after years of the presence of U.S. occupation forces at the triangle border between Syria, Iraq and Jordan, which is known as Al-Tanf base, I believe that stressing on the continuation of this occupation, as per the Hoover School of Geopolitics, is simply to prevent ties between Syria, Iraq, Iran and Jordan too. Closing the borders at that specific triangle aims at hindering military, economic and political ties between the countries of the region. Hence, this is a strategic goal for the United States of America. But can the U.S. challenge three countries by breaching their borders and hindering them from forging ties with one another against their will? I think that is impossible, simply because the aim of the U.S. is beyond that. It aims at disintegrating Syria and Iraq. For instance, in Iraq, the U.S. is currently working on creating a separatist entity of Sunni Iraqis similar to the separatist Kurds in Syria. In the end, will this plan work? I believe the opposite will happen. All of Iran, Iraq, Syria, and the resistance factions in Syria and Iraq will increase their efforts to spoil the U.S. plans for the region. I personally believe that the U.S. will not remain inside Syria for more than 1 year. That will be possible due to the boiling security situation, not only in West Asia, but also between Russia and Ukraine, and due to the Chinese threat against U.S. hegemony in Taiwan. So there is a global wave against U.S. hegemony, and so regionally it is obvious that the axis of resistance that has the upper hand in the fight against every form of occupation inside Syria and Iraq as well.
Well, Mr. Tahsin, I definitely hear what you're saying, but according to the official U.S. statement that was released after the attack on Deir ez-Zor, it says that seven infrastructure facilities of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard were targeted in Deir ez-Zor in order to, and I quote, protect American bases from additional attacks, unquote. By claiming to target these Iranian so-called groups, the U.S. dodges the biggest question of all. What are they doing occupying Syrian land to begin with? I mean, the international community is obviously on another planet, but how much longer do you think the U.S. can play this game when 80% of the country is liberated and back in the hands of the Syrian Arab army?
I believe that the U.S. is trying to tell both Iraq and Syria that the presence of its soldiers in Syria and the war it is waging on the peoples of these two countries aims to simply remove those so-called militias. While knowing that it is these resistance groups in Syria and Iraq are the ones who initially stood against Daesh and Nusra, who came to be with European and American funding and training, these resistance factions are the ones capable of fighting and winning over the Takfiri terrorists of Daesh and Nusra, and not the US occupation whatsoever. It was evident later on, after the global war on Syria began, that it is in fact the US that is supporting these Takfiri groups instead of fighting these terrorists. This is why the US feels compelled to destroy the factions that belongs to the axis of resistance that chose to challenge the American schemes on West Asia. These resistance factions are defending their countries, their lands, from Takfiri terrorism. The Iranian, Iraqi and Syrian people know very well that it is the axis of resistance that rid them from terrorism and not the Americans whatsoever.
I want to thank you very much, Mr. Tahsin Al-Halabi, political commentator and researcher, for your contribution about talking about the intensified attacks against the U.S. occupation in Syria. And thank you. Please stay tuned because the upcoming couple of weeks are going to be intense in West Asia, most probably between Israel and Lebanon. So stay tuned next week on the Middle East Stream.
This is
for a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I have been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. You're welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. Well, we are talking about patience according to Islamic teachings. But before that, before we go into detail, I would like to mention one thing, brothers and sisters. Faith may be defined as something which consists of ethics, legal rights, and public instructions. The same is the case for any other constructive social school or organization. We may therefore classify faith into the following. First of all, this is the basis of understanding of man and the world. It is called worldview. Second, on the basis of these principles, there is the overall direction for the movement in human action. This is called ideology. And then within these boundaries, guidelines and regulations for relationship of man with Allah, with self, with fellow human beings and with other creatures. And this is what we call akhlaq-e-amali, okay? This is practical ethics. And then a series of moral guides, for maintaining the required necessary momentum or endeavor for achieving perfection and exaltedness and accomplishing success in various fields of life. So faith will not be complete unless ethics, legal rights, and instructions are there. Faith is not only about belief in God and belief in the day of resurrection and no practice. Practice is a part of faith. This vast complex includes personal matters related to the personal interest of the individual, as well as social matters pertaining to various large groups of humanity. And affairs concerning these groups and the Islamic community. Let us see the complex of faith. What is the influence and the role played by patience?
We were given so many prizes. We changed the desert into oases. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes. And we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought. Couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor, cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact, to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
In other words, a person committed to religion will act as follows. He must believe in religious principles, he must obey the religious regulations, and he must be familiar with the special clauses dealing with ethics. And if one fulfills all the above three in his conduct, he could rightly be called a true believer. A true believer is one who believes not only in the fundamentals of faith, but he also practices the code of conduct. He also practices the moral instructions and follows the moral standards. And we will now examine the role played by patience in the life of a believer in following religion in its true sense. Brothers and sisters, let us see what influence and role is played by patience in the, in the geometrical figure representing the faith of a true believer. Let's consider the example of an automobile which is supposed to move someone together with his household belongings to a certain location. After passing through various streets, this automobile finally reaches the desired final destination. What is responsible for moving this automobile? Is it the engine? What thing is responsible for providing the strength or power to the engine? Of course, it is the petrol. It is the gas.
Therefore, in the life of a believer, patience may be compared to the engine or the petrol which gives life and strength to that engine. And it's, of course, it's a good example for you, brothers and sisters, to understand the role and the importance of patience. Patience is something that serves as, that plays the role of an engine. Without patience, the truth and steadfast logic of the exalted school of religion would not have been understood. Without patience, the truth would not have been established, and the religion of Islam would not have been spread. The divine learning, the revelation of this school, the school of Islam, which blessed humanity, would have lost its color with the passage of time. The ultimate hope of victory of truth over falsehood, which provides fresh, life-giving blood for powerful hands and steadfast steps of believers, would have been silenced. And the laws and guidelines of religion, which control and check the human tendencies of transgression, would have become inactive.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Brothers and sisters, patience plays such a tremendous role. It serves as an engine that gives power, that it serves as the petrol that gives that makes the engine move and the automobile to move ahead. And let's give the example of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, who exercised patience despite hardship. Of course, there, if we go through the life of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, we understand very clearly that the Prophet suffered a lot, especially when he was in Mecca. And when he lived along with his wife Khadija and his daughter Fatima Zahra Salamullah Alayha, they lived for a few years in the valley of She'b, which is called She'b Abi Talib, and they suffered the most. They were threatened to death by the enemies, who had forced them to seek protection by living in that valley. But for many years they stayed there, they suffered, they tolerated. The Prophet was somehow encircled by the enemies. Somehow the Prophet tolerated, his family also tolerated the situation. And he, after 13 years, the Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, left Mecca for Medina. And there is light at the end of the tunnel. When the Prophet, peace be upon him, arrived in Medina, he had already suffered a lot at the hands of the enemies, the Quraysh, who had left no stone unturned to harm him, to torment him. But finally the Prophet made it, and he was successful in spreading the message of Islam in Medina. And from there, the message of Islam spread all over Hijaz and then across the region. This shows the importance of patience. Had the Prophet not been patient, had his companions not been patient, of course, that truth would not have been established. The message of Islam would not have been spread. That is it. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows. Allah knows.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. Pro-choice advocates in Arizona, United States have said a ruling by a judge, which is likely to be appealed, would take Arizonans back to living under an archaic 150-year-old law. Stay with us for more on this story. The Associated Press has covered the story. Arizona can enforce a near-total ban on abortions that has been blocked for nearly 50 years. A judge ruled on Friday, 23rd of September, meaning that clinics statewide will have to stop providing the procedures to avoid criminal charges against doctors and other medical workers. The judge lifted a decades-old injunction that blocked enforcement of the law on the books since before Arizona became a state. The only exception to the ban is if the woman's life is in jeopardy. The ruling means the state's abortion clinics will have to shut down, and anyone seeking an abortion will have to go out of state. The ruling takes effect immediately, although an appeal is possible. Abortion providers have been on a roller coaster ride since last June, when the U.S. Supreme Court overturned the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade, a decision guaranteeing women a constitutional right to an abortion, allowing states to regulate abortion as they wish. Planned Parenthood had urged the judge not to allow enforcement, and its president declared that the ruling takes Arizonans back to living under an archaic 150-year-old law. Mark Brnovich, the Republican Attorney General of Arizona, who had urged the judge to lift the injunction so the ban could be enforced, cheered the decision. "We applaud the court for upholding the will of the legislature and providing clarity and uniformity on this important issue," Mark Brnovich said. The ruling comes amid an election season in which Democrats have seized on abortion rights as a potent issue. Senator Mark Kelly, under a challenge from Republican Blake Masters, said it will have a devastating impact on the freedom Arizona women have had for decades to choose an abortion. Democrat Katie Hobbs, who is running for governor, called it the product of a decades-long attack on reproductive freedom by Republicans that can only be fended off by voters this November. Blake Masters and Kerry Lake, the Republican running against Katie Hobbs, both back abortion restrictions. The near-total abortion ban was enacted decades before Arizona secured statehood in 1912. Prosecutions were halted after the injunction was handed down after the Roe decision. Even so, the legislature reenacted the law several times, most recently in 1977. Under the law, anyone convicted of performing a surgical abortion or providing drugs for the medication abortion could face 2 to 5 years in prison. Bans on abortion at any point in pregnancy were in place in 12 Republican-led states. In Wisconsin, abortion clinics have stopped providing abortions amid litigation over whether an 1849 ban is in effect. Georgia bans abortions once fetal cardiac activity can be detected. Florida and Utah have bans on abortion that kick in after 15 and 18 weeks, respectively. The ruling also came a day before a new Arizona law banning abortions after 15 weeks of pregnancy takes effect. The Reuters news agency has more on this story. An Arizona judge ruled on Friday, 23rd of September, that a 1901 ban on nearly all abortions in the state can be enforced after being blocked for about 50 years, a decision that drew immediate criticism from abortion rights activists and Democrats and is likely to be appealed. Pima County Superior Court Judge Kelly Johnson granted a request by the state's Republican Attorney General to lift the court injunction that had barred enforcement of Arizona's pre-statehood ban on abortion after the U.S. Supreme Court ruled in Roe v. Wade in 1973. Judge Kelly Johnson's ruling bans all abortions in Arizona except when the procedure is necessary to save the mother's life. Abortion rights advocacy group Planned Parenthood said, "The ruling has the practical and deplorable result of sending Arizonans back nearly 150 years. Democratic gubernatorial nominee Katie Hobbs said she was outraged and devastated by the judge's decision. The court finds that because the legal basis for the judgment entered in 1973 has now been overruled, it must vacate the judgment in its entirety." Judge Kelly Johnson said in her ruling, "The Supreme Court in June overturned the right to abortion it had recognized in the landmark 1973 Roe v. Wade ruling. We applaud the court for upholding the will of the legislature and providing clarity and uniformity on this important issue," Arizona Attorney General Mark Bernovich said in a tweet after the judge's ruling. Democrats have been eager to cast Republicans as extreme on the abortion issue since the U.S. Supreme Court last June overturned Roe v. Wade and many states began enforcing abortion bans.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we discuss your problems, questions you have regarding the Islamic upbringing of your children. A child is like a white paper on which you can write good things or bad things. Entire personality of a child is developed by the parents, by the upbringing they do. And in this program, we try to provide all the necessary information that is required to bring up your child in the best possible way. The answers of your questions are based upon Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Today in our studio, we have had the pleasure to invite Professor Salman Nakavi, who is a faculty member of Al-Mustafa University and researcher in the Hawza Ilmiya of Qom. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you very much.
All right. In our previous sessions, we have been talking about that parents as educators need to have a certain set of knowledge and skills. So we talked about knowledge, and now I want to ask you, what kind of skills do parents need to have when they are upbringing their children in an Islamic way?
Yes, we would have to talk about the skills. And before that, we need to expand upon the issue of the emotions also, especially regarding chastity.
Okay.
That was something which we just mentioned. I mean, being afif, as is in Arabic, chaste, or being able to manage that lust and desire, that is very important, whether it is pertains to food or other things which are required for our health, for our physical fitness. And then even when it comes to the opposite sex, which is very important, especially for ourselves and for our children, controlling the feelings regarding, I mean, these feelings are natural. If they are not there, human beings will not survive. The continuity of the human race is based on this very instinct. Just as the as any other animal would be would require this to be able to continue the rate of the, its species in this world, the human being also requires this feeling, which is important. It has to be managed. It has to be controlled. And that is the equilibrium we want to achieve. There are two extremes where one, for example, one is over, for example, when it comes to food, it's it expresses itself in overeating.
Okay.
One has a temptation for good or delicious food, and he starts eating without any consideration for his health.
True.
Or even if it's not an issue of health, maybe it's an issue of being completely engrossed in something which is
not having control on yourself.
Material is okay. A material gain.
True.
And you are eat so many delicious foods. The more you get engrossed in that enterprise of eating,
yeah,
the more you move away from spirituality.
All right.
So controlling your eating habits and other things which we like to do. And also when it comes to sexual relationships with the opposite sex, it has to be controlling this. Of course, when it comes to the halal way of doing it, that is very much emphasized in Islam. That should be done in a very in a manner which gives you complete relaxation and satisfaction. That is very important for human beings to be able to experience well-being.
Yeah.
As it is with food, it is also with this issue.
All right.
It should not be on either extremes, especially becoming a state where one does not desire to eat food.
Okay,
that is not good.
Well, so you're trying to say that being lusty or having desires is okay. That's one should not go through this obsessive compulsion disorder.
One should not why do it for the sake of greed.
And why do I have this? But they have to control it, use it in a halal way, be that desires or be that lust. Well, I'll ask more to you about that after a short break. The listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing. We're talking about the control of emotions and the skills required by parents. Yes.
So, once that we ourselves are able to control ourselves and manage our relations and manage our feelings, and we are able to, when we engage with in different relationships, especially with our children, with our spouses, with our children, there we have to completely come out of the other relationships which we have. The baggage should not come with it. If we have any problems,
even if we are in the worldly relationships of our family, we have to be sincere even there. When we are with family, we are with family.
We're with family. Just forget what was happening today at work. Leave that behind. Come
home. Do
not
bash out on your family, whatever.
So your passion, your engagement with your family should be completely for them.
Okay.
That is sincerity of purpose there. Allah Almighty wants us to get engaged in that relationship with sincerity.
Mm-hmm.
And all our feelings and understandings should be for that sake. So all our feelings, emotions, anger, they should not be allowed to get involved. If there's some issue where we are pent up, where we have pented up feelings at the place of work or at any other place outside the house, we should leave that, forget that. We should be able to, as a computer makes folders, a computer program, you make folders.
Yeah.
And you, from one folder to the other folder, you come out of this folder, you go into the other folder, you forget what was there in the other folder. So we have to be able to have this technique.
That
we are able to make compartments in our life.
True.
And make demarcations. And then manage our thoughts and feelings according to those folders in a very intellectual way.
So you are trying to say that we need to have skills when we as parents are able to manage our feelings. We are not mixing our external feelings with our internal feelings in our family, with the other members of the family. We need to have these set of skills.
Emotional skills, yes. True. Mental skills, emotional things. Skills.
That's how we are teaching a child that he does not repeat that tomorrow in his own life.
Exactly. Time management skills.
Okay.
Practical skills are required. Time management, communication skills, how we communicate. Communication skills is something which is overarching. It is a cross-cutting issue where whenever you're engaged with a communication, even with Allah Almighty, when we're communicating in the form of prayers, that requires certain skills.
True.
Here also, the communication skills, how we express what we feel. One of the issues that we have, for example, as a parent, I love my child, but I'm not able to express my love for him in a way that he is able to understand.
So this expression of love requires skills.
It's not just having love, it is the
expression
of love.
True. We will talk more on what kind of skills are still required by parents in the Islamic upbringing after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, "He who has a child must treat him in a childish manner."
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. We're talking about how parents can control their emotions, what set of rules are required that are essential for Islamic upbringing of the children. Well, Professor, you told us about the certain set of skills. You also talked about one of the important skills, that was communication with God. We often see parents who don't reach their desires in the world, and the communication with God is like, "You really don't have any love left for me. That's why you want your servant to suffer in this world like this." So when a child hears certain kind of communication of a parent with God, do you think it has impact on his the way he believes in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala?
Certainly, when anyone, especially a parent, would like to express in a way this feeling that, oh Allah Almighty, I have no hope left in you, you have left me on my own. That's.
I mean, there are certain things, like, for example, if a particular person passes away, or if a particular tragedy comes to a person, like Islam teaches us, say over here, inna lillahi wa inna ilayhi raji'un. Despite of reacting like this, we have many, many parents, many, many people over there who react like, who communicate with God in a way, you only have tragedies for me. You particularly want to target me. Why you have all tragedies for me? Don't you think this kind of question, this kind of communication with God, teach self-centricness to a child?
Yes, certainly. I mean, you need to make... comes back to the understanding that the parent should have. And that is the bigger picture. And in the bigger picture, whoever faces more difficulties, more tragedies, he becomes more closer to God.
Okay. So
for many people, that is a way of that Allah Almighty is providing for us, facilitating us to move to Him at a quicker pace. I mean, those who become close to Allah, they are put to more tests and trials and tribulations. They are given more opportunities to make them excel. So this is the mindset that has to change. That comes back to the bigger picture, realizing and understanding the bigger picture. So a parent should understand that. So this communication in the form of becoming hopeless in God is something which goes back to the correct understanding of the truth. And then if we have this mindset, that we are going to impart the same thing to the child. So we need to be able to have good communication skills with our children, expressing our pure love in a proper way. Time management, because we have many hadiths which say that you need to classify your time. So yeah. We'll talk about that in the future.
Inshallah. Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Naqavi. So we have a certain set of skills as parents that we need to be having. Even our communication with God, even when we are hopeless, it's very important what we are communicating, what we are talking, the tone we are talking in to God and others. All those skills are required, all that has impact. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners, for listening to IRIP English Radio. In case you have any questions, comments or suggestions, please contact us at englishradio@irib.ir. You can also find us on social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio or our official website, that's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanallah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life, a complete way. Islam solves all of our problems. Allah leaves no stone unturned. Perfect with no flaws at all are the laws of Allah.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.